We're talking about science today. First off, regular voice on Kaleidoscope, that is Dr. Samineh Shaheen, Professor of Organisational Behaviour and Leadership at Holt University and Learning and People Development Specialist. Hello, good morning to you.
Good morning, Suzanne.
It's good to have you here and to get your insights as a psychologist into some of the discussions we're having today. We have joining us at table Adam Griffin, Senior Paediatric Occupational Therapist at Kamali Clinic, but he's also a regular at Café Scientifique, who's also a speaker at SciFest Dubai. Hello and welcome back, Adam.
Hello, Suzanne. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. So it's good to have you at table and to find out what we're talking about at Café Scientifique. Very special guest. It's a real pleasure to welcome to the show Simon Ings, Arts and Culture Editor of the New Scientist magazine. Hello to you, sir.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks so much for being here. It's very exciting indeed. We're going to find out a bit about your history and connection with the written word and science and some of the stories that you've been sharing. But in particular, what you'll be talking about at Café Scientifique with your new book, Stalin and the Scientist. Tell me about this. It's a big one. It's a big, thick, heavy book I can see in front of you there.
It's a book that took me 5 years and I wrote on the bus. Basically, I fell in love with a psychologist by the name of Alexander Luria, and was working in the 1930s through to the 1970s. And he essentially invented popular science as a genre, as a thing to read. He wrote these absolutely extraordinary case histories, worked with a couple of patients, edited the diary of a client of his who had severe brain damage from a gunshot wound. And so he made people like Oliver Sacks possible. And he led an extraordinarily ordinary life. He had friends, he travelled abroad, everyone loved him, he had a big family. So when it came time to try and write a biography about him, and that's what I wanted to do originally, I discovered that there was almost nothing to say. But except for the fact that he shouldn't have had an ordinary life because he grew up under Stalin. He lived at a time when everybody was being sacked, shot, exiled. How was it possible that he led an ordinary life? So from this very small little project of wanting to write about one person to explain why his life was odd, I ended up having to write about everything, the whole of the scientific base of the Soviet Union. And from there, the project just escalated and escalated. A more classic example of mission creep I can't think of than this book, because, you know, you start off writing about a psychologist and you end up writing about Stalin, essentially.
Isn't that wonderful, though? I mean, I know challenging in the hours of that it consumes you, but, and you are also an author, Samineh, but when you start off with that first idea, but that journey, that road takes you elsewhere, and so you're learning and sharing through the written word.
I think there's a huge benefit for at least not believing that you know anything. I think there's an ethical point to be made here about journalists, is that if journalists think they know something, there's something wrong. You should always start from the point of view of huge curiosity and a belief in your own ignorance, and then you are led down extraordinary trails. It might enable you to get at the truth, but on the way you'll have adventures and be able to share them with people and entertain people and inform them at the same time, which is the job.
Right. And I couldn't agree more with you in the fact that the objective is that sharing of the journey, right? Because truth is relative.
Yes.
And what you think that you may have arrived at are these incredible truths that may not be the same for the readers. And I think it's wonderful to be open to the trajectories and the different branches that we come across as the story unfolds. And, you know, what you thought perhaps wasn't so significant at the beginning becomes incredibly significant throughout, or definitely at the end.
There's another thing about the truth as well, which is that it doesn't stay still.
Correct.
And as you say, what is important at one moment ceases to be important the next, and something else becomes essentially important. And this is what I discovered was the tragedy of the Bolshevik project, is that you had a society, a group of people who wanted to create a better society through science. but had no idea how fluid science was.
Right.
They had an idea of scientific positivism, which is basically a way of saying everything is explainable by everything else. So psychology is explainable by brain function, is explainable by biology, which is explainable by chemistry, and everything connects neatly together, which is a very 19th century, traditional 19th century idea. And they created a scientific state based upon the ability to explain everything at the exact point where in several scientific fields people at the top of their game were going, oh, it doesn't work. The world isn't rational. We've got tools. We can explain bits of the world, but we can't explain all of it. And they locked themselves into an idea that just was never going to work.
Mm-hmm. Well, part of this journey as well, I suppose, in that sort of sense of saying somebody is a regular chap, but is maybe exploring and creating something, but there is this restriction, or there's a bias, or there's, you know, it's being prohibited to continue in a certain way. And, you know, some people may call that a mad scientist. And that term mad scientist is something we're going to explore when we come back and find out more about the book. And also how science influences your everyday life. Seems maybe obvious, but think about it. Science, what does that mean? And how is it influencing you day to day? Talking science today on Kaleidoscope with Dr. Samineh Shaheen alongside Adam Griffin and a special guest. When we're talking about science writing novelist, that is Simon Ings. We were just talking there a little bit about his latest non-fiction book, that is Stalin and the Scientists, and I'm holding the book in my hand, A History of Triumph and Tragedy, 1905 to 1953, and how Simon started this book and where it led him. And we were just getting into the idea and notion of the mad scientist, that term. So how do we define that? Where does it come from?
I think you have to look back to Mary Shelley and her book Frankenstein, and the idea of the independent scholar who is going to create some abnormal and hard to accept reality which will then run amok. And that taps into the Gothic, it taps into fairy tale. And yet it has had an absolute grip on our idea of what science is. It's had an even tighter grip on our idea of what medicine is. And I think a large part of that is to do with our discomfort when we discover that science and medicine do not stay still. Medicine especially does not stay still, and what is true at one moment is not true in another. So there is the sense that it is out of control, and there's a reason for that. It is.
Yeah, and just to sort of, you know, put it in context, so when we're talking about Frankenstein, which was published in 1818, and the sort of period in history that you're addressing through your book, so into the 20th century and where we are today. So I guess through information and sharing of information and academics, we might be more, I think, maybe more accepting than maybe back then. So interesting how, yes, true, science and research, it never stops, it continues, but how we accept it or embrace it could be a challenge or not, as the case may be. But I love that idea, even though it's scary, that something that's out of control, and that's what makes us nervous.
I think if I can take a few steps back refer to one of my favorite Russian psychologists, Vygotsky, and his social theory, we're social animals. And for societies to survive, you need conformity. And if you've got individuals who are too curious and they're observant and analytical and they're questioning things and they're engaged in critical analysis, there's going to be lots of questioning going on. And questioning questions norms. And that can destabilize us. So in many ways, it's necessary and it's ongoing, but it also feels threatening.
Mm. Adam?
Yeah, I think it's part of the perhaps a little bit of a misunderstanding of science as well in the public perception, that there is in the scientific world we have a consensus in most things. So you have what the literature is telling you, but science needs those kind of rabble risers as well. So you have people understand that there is a process that goes through it, but you need people who question the sort of the accepted notions of things. And science, especially the science of this period, lends itself quite well. That back in the, when you go back to things like the 18th, 19th century, most science was done by people who could afford to do science, who called themselves natural philosophers, and they tended to be quite kind of out there, quirky characters who did all sorts of bonkers things we'll probably talk about in a little while. But it's, so there was this idea that science was otherworldly. It wasn't part of the thing that normal people would get into. It was something in the realms of boffinry. Even today, when I work with kids and teenagers, if I ask a teenager to draw a scientist, it'll be kind of half Einstein, half Professor Widows of this fooling straws in the hair mad scientist looking fellow. I didn't say a mad scientist, I just said a scientist. And that's what they end up doing. And the other thing I kind of want to pull back to as well, at the beginning we talked a lot about the pursuit of truth in science. It's kind of, we walked around it a little bit as well, that the gaining like an ultimate truth isn't really the goal of science. And some people hold this up, especially when you look at what we call kind of bro science or Facebook science, the stuff people post on their walls. It's very kind of a, it's like little clickbait sort of stuff, and it changes all the time. Oh, science is saying this, now it's changed its mind. Oh, science can't even agree with itself, it's worthless. No, it's not the case. Science is meant to disagree with itself. There isn't one truth. When we talk about pursuit of truth, that truth isn't the important word there, it's the pursuit that's the important word, and that it has a self-correcting measure built into it.
I think there's a always going to be a formal problem with science in that the only way you can communicate it is through a story. So popular science and telling stories about science is science. That's what science is. And stories have a tendency to have nice, neat conclusions and then to say, well, that's the story of that. And now I'm going to tell you a completely different story to take in this next bit of information. It's very uncomfortable if you're not used to that way of thinking. And I remember I wrote a book about eyesight, and there was a fantastic paper I found by a man called John Mullen. And he wrote a paper saying there is only one way you can explain how humans see colour. There is only one way you can make this story remotely comprehensible. And to do this, you have to put that fact in front of the other fact and get the time wrong, leave out that vital researcher and come back to them far later, which is massively unfair to the poor person. And he just went through each point of the argument explaining why there was only one way to explain this. And it was correct in that it gave you an idea of why we see colour. And historical and factual nonsense, because it put all the facts in the wrong order. It was quite an astonishing piece of work.
Which then, you know, the whole idea of stories and how do we communicate stories and the way those stories change and the sort of additions and the subtractions of what we remember and what we confabulate because we think it's more creative to add these, you know, bits to it as we share the story to others adds another layer of complexity.
Do you think that if when you were writing the book and looking at that time in history and that culture as well, so Soviet Union and the idea that people wanted sort of neat answers and everything was connected in some way, do you think that's how we are today? Do you find that's on the whole the consensus is we want to feel that everything's neat and straight lines?
I think the more pressure you have on your environment, on your food supply, on your institutions, on your ability to get to work, on your personal safety, the more you want simple and straightforward answers. And in extremis, you reach for scientists to give you straight answers, which they will never, ever do. It's not their job. And what you find in the early Soviet Union, in fact, what you find in Russia generally, because it's so hard to feed the population of Russia, it's got a very, very small amount of fertile land, a band of black earth, which it long put under the plough. Back in the early 19th century, it was all under the plough. And so every ruler of the Russian Confederation, Russian Empire, whatever you like to call it, is always reaching for quick solutions, easy solutions. And they look to science for, because they know that that is ultimately where the solutions will come from. And scientists can't give you easy answers. Now, if our with the problems that we now have with the climate, with the problems that we now have with an ever-increasing population and reaching the point where our food can't feed our people in the next generation or two, we are going to be asking easy answers. I don't see that that's not going to happen. I don't think you can educate people out of doing that. It's a very natural and necessary thing to do. You become desperate.
We are talking science today. We've got Café Scientifique, and joining us in studio today, that is the arts and culture editor of the New Scientist magazine, that is Simon Ings. Great to have you here, Simon.
Lovely to be here.
Thank you very much. And talking about Simon's book that was published back in October 2016, Stalin and the Scientists. So exploring some of the personalities, some of those people of that time that maybe felt the oppression of Stalin and weren't able to push through their ideas, research and conclusions as well. Talking about science today, this is in his words, he likes to call himself a nerd, and we are proud of him for that. That is Adam Griffin, who is speaking at SciFest Dubai this year, also a regular at Café Scientifique. He's also a senior paediatric occupational therapist based at the Kamali Clinic.
Hello, I'm very happy to fly the flag for the nerds of Dubai.
Hurrah. Hurrah for this sort of thing.
Exactly.
That was the nerdiest response.
And
a compliment.
Really lovely, as always, to have at my side Professor of Organisational Behaviour and Leadership at Holt University and Learning and People Development Specialist, Cross-Cultural Psychologist, that is Dr. Saminé Shaheen. First time talking science with us today. And, you know, psychology is always an interesting one. I remember I did, like, O-level psychology, and it's like, that's not a proper topic, a subject. That's not really science. Mm. Is that something you've had to contend with as a psychologist?
I have, absolutely. And it is a science. It's very much a science. Philosophy, on the other hand, may be in a different category, but psychology, you know, it has to go through the same rigorous process to ensure that it's valid, it's reliable, that it's up to date. And in many ways, absolutely, we have to jump through the same hoops for validity.
Yeah, I think anyone in the right mind would say, yes, psychology is definitely a science, unless you're speaking to a physicist, because they don't think anything except physics is a science. Biology is just messing with gunky, sticky stuff. Chemistry is just playing in the kitchen. But
there we go.
And now we have the technology, you know, the technological revolution of the last 50 years happening as well. So there's a lot of, you know, so your techies and your entrepreneurs. So there's a lot that it encompasses when we use that word science. Mm. It was a full moon yesterday. Just to add in, I was sitting out at Bab al-Shams in the desert watching that full moon, which was absolutely beautiful. I took a moment. I thought of the conversation today. Astronomy, space travel, all of that is part of the word, that one word, science. So what excites you and what do you think when it comes to science and how it is maybe with your kids in school and when it comes to research? Medicine, that's another huge area, the environment, the natural world, and asking you how science influences your everyday life. So lots of messages coming in. And we were just talking before about, you know, exploring that era of Soviet Union, Stalin, as your tagline is on the book, A History of Triumph and Tragedy, 1905 to 1953. And I was asking you whether you can compare it today in the sense that do we feel the need for answers to everything, connections to everything? We're not so comfortable with the idea of something that might be open-ended and keep exploring, and maybe it's about making mistakes. And as we were talking about the definition of mad scientist, the idea of letting things go out of control a little to then learn and regroup and move forward. Adam, you wanted to come back on this point.
Yeah, the idea of that it's open-ended, that something Simon said really struck home with me, that you were talking about when you put more pressure on people, if they're more stressed and the environment has more things going on that are a little bit negative perhaps, then they want kind of more cookie-cutter answers, something kind of tied together a little bit more. And science at its heart doesn't really offer that very well. For example, we were talking just off air, but if you read any research journal, any clinical journal article, which is the bread and butter of science really, the end line will almost invariably say more research is needed in this area. And it may be very, very solid, showing really profound results, but it'll still say this. To the extent that now journals like The Lancet and a lot of the like major international publications have banned it, they won't allow you to say that because it says it adds nothing. But if I have, for example, a family family and they have a child who has a profound disability, but it's insidious in its sense. So they don't know the reason for this. Then when they read, they'll come in with research about it, material, and say, well, it says more research is needed. They don't know. No, this is just what science says. It always says it. Science isn't about knowing for sure. It's about getting a closer approximation to the truth every time.
I think one of the reasons I was also attracted to cross-cultural psychology was the fact that, you know, every time you conduct a research, there's a population sample that you're dealing with. And when you are perhaps researching a different population sample from a different cultural background, the findings may be different. And of course, we always open up our research. We invite other researchers to replicate the study to validate what we have found. But it's also open for adding to literature and adding to the findings, in that within this particular population, findings may be different due to the cultural attributes and criteria that are not the same in Bombay as they are in Minnesota.
The classic example of that, the really easy example of that, I suppose, is the idea of IQ, the intelligence quotient, which was invented by a man who, when he presented the IQ, say, this doesn't really work, because if I presented this test to someone from a different country, I'd get a radically different result. From the moment it was thought up, people knew there was a problem. This is not new. People knew from day one that we're measuring something, but it's so socially and culturally relative. It's very, very difficult to get good data out of it.
Fascinating.
Yeah, and which reminds me of a beautiful English expression, don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. And I often say this in a diverse classroom and people are quite confused. You know, what does that mean? So what do? Do we throw out the test because there are these questions around it? Yeah. No, we hang on to it. But there's measures in place to try and ensure at least its effectiveness to a certain extent.
Yeah, I sort of grew up with that expression. I can tell you it doesn't really translate sometimes, because I used it here. And then it was translated by someone into Arabic, and the looks I got, that it was like, oh my God, they're throwing my babies now in Ireland.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, this, it sounds to me there's sort of two things going on here, in the sense of, you know, if we're talking about the mad scientist idea, so there's the for the layman is, you know, it's just an indulgence for somebody to be able to spend all that time researching, do what they're doing, but without really coming to a conclusion. Is it self-indulgent? Is it just, you know, it's a bit chaotic and messy, possibly? That's putting it in layman's terms. There's that one strand that might go against science developing or the individual's research or group's research. And then there's the other side of it. You mentioned Frankenstein and that sort of idea of the ghoulish and the bizarre and maybe the obscene, and it being something almost mystical and out of this world, and that's scary. Ooh, that's scary. And you know, we're living in an age where we think we are sophisticated now, and we understand what is really frightening or not frightening. But is that the case? I mean, do you agree they're sort of two of the sort of strands that have maybe given the scientist a bad rap?
I think the one of the characteristics of the mad scientist is that they're always the mad scientist of 10 years ago, or 50 years ago, or 100 years ago. Or if someone is being accused of being a mad scientist, they're accused of being old-fashioned, of trying to do something in the past. I think the idea of the mad scientist, it's one of those creatures that you're afraid of as a child, that somehow contains uncertainty and puts it into an object or a person or a target. And we contain the idea that now we know what we're doing. If I go over here into this shiny institute, which has been running for years and with people I respect and whose papers I've read, I can trust this. Well, only up to a point. A very good example of what is described as Frankenstein science is frontal lobotomy. The way that you can treat people for severe neurological and psychological disorders by basically damaging their brains in a particular way, by really quite grotesque invasive surgery, once conducted with an ice pick. Now, could you imagine of anything more like a Frankenstein science? And yet, at the time when it was being conducted, you had a choice. You either gave people this operation, or you put them in institutions that were massively overcrowded with no drug treatments available, where they were beating their heads against the walls. if you gave them this treatment, they could go back and live with their families. They would have a nice, quiet life. And the person who invented this treatment, who was regarded as a Frankenstein figure by the establishment by the time he died, when he died, died in a house full of flowers, sent, as they were sent every day, by his patients. So a considerable number of people didn't regard him as Frankenstein. And it's the idea that in the past we got it wrong, but we're there now. We've got it right now. And I think it's always interesting to wonder, what are the things we're doing at the moment that seem reasonable to us, which are then going to fall away and seem crazy?
Talking with Simon Ings, art and culture editor of New Scientist, alongside Adam Griffin and Dr. Saminae Shaheen.
Before the break there, we were talking a little bit about this idea of mad scientists. And one of the things I wanted to talk about is how, when you look at these sensational stories about how mad science of now, it always is kind of a microcosm of what's going on in the culture. For example, in the 1990s, it was all bioscience and bio kind of horror stuff about scientists were growing ears on the backs of mice and things like this. Did happen, but it's the shock factor of that. And these days, quite a lot of it is related to technology. So we have stories about AI and how it's going to be the rise of machines, and scientists are once again dabbling in things they ought not to do. So you do need those ethical checks and balances, but those stories have always been there.
Yeah, and I think as a result of those stories and those experiments, we fine-tune our ethical guidelines and, you know, what is possible and what isn't possible to try and prevent and avoid things in the future. One of the studies that always fascinates me is Dr. Money. He was interested to look at whether children are born gender neutral or is, you know, and is gender shaped through society and upbringing. And there was a case of twin boys, and they had a routine circumcision done, as and one of the boys had complications in the circumcision. And long story short, they decided to raise one of the boys as a girl. And Dr. Money, because he was interested in the subject, believed that with the right upbringing and environment, that child could be nurtured into feeling more comfortable and connected to being a girl. Well, I mean, unfortunately, the outcome of this experiment was very, very sad. It led to lots of problems and dysfunctions in the future, but we learned a lot as a result about gender and gender assignment.
You know, especially that when you learn a lot, and but you're talking about the ethics. For example, a lot of medicine, definitely a lot of psychology, the experiments you talk about in like first year psychology as an undergraduate, ethically, you would never be allowed to do them today.
Never.
When you talk about Bandura's Bobo Wall experiments, and even like famously a guy called Stanley Milgram did tests about obedience in populations, you would the psychological trauma you're inflicting on the people involved in them, you'd never get away with it. But it's the bedrock of a lot of psychology we work with.
Yeah,
today.
But also it works the other way, isn't it? That there's also been a lot of science research that today will not be acceptable, particularly in the realms of using animals in testing. Obviously, that still goes on to some extent, but there are other areas which would be deemed way too cruel or way not effective, not of value to help the human race. I Googled this morning real-life mad scientists, and I have to say most of which I can't share with you on air today, what has been going on in history when it comes to science. But one here, which was the testing of... it says that basically the question was, what is love? And this is with scientist Harry Harlow. He's described as the monkey torturer. Now, you may tell me different. I'm just reading this off the page. But he decided to find out about the bond between child and mother. So he did studies with monkey babies and their mums to find the nature of love itself and what could be more noble. But one scenario is where he would put a monkey into isolation for like 12 months. So it was totally on its own. And of course, it sent itself mad. It went crazy. And what came out of that study or that research was, yes, love is, we need someone else to feel love, and we need love to nurture, and then the socialization.
Yeah, if I can just add to that as well, one of the other scenarios were that he would shoot out jets of hot air and spikes into the monkeys with these sort of wired monkeys that he had, a pseudo-mother monkeys, and he wanted to see how the rhesus infant monkeys would react. And the outcome and the findings as a result of that was, why is it that children who are being abused run back to their care providers? The fact that the love and the attachment trumps overshadows, and it's even stronger than the abuse that they experience. But again, like you said, Suzanne, today, impossible that a researcher would get away with creating such conditions.
Fascinating area, though, again, that word.
I think that the big ethical issue at the moment is compared to those examples, relatively benign sounding, and that is the degree to which you can use surveillance data to extract information about how people behave in situations. So, for example, and I honestly don't know what to think about this one, there was a study conducted on people at work that used surveillance footage and email records to see how people's productivity was affected by giving them more water cooler moments. And the conclusion of the study was that if you actually let people just chat and shoot the breeze, their productivity is increased. And that's a very nice, warm, glad finding, because we're now all going to be treated better at work. At the same time, the people who were the subjects of this study weren't informed that the study was going on, at which point you think, you've been reading all these emails and you've been watching them all the hours that they've been at work. And productivity doing what exactly? And so this use of big data to find information, I think, is a really difficult ethical issue to deal with. We're not used to knowing this much about each other. We're just not used to it.
Polly says, I absolutely love science, but it's around us all the time. Just every single moment I'm holding my phone, there you go, there's science in your hand. Yeah, what do you think about it? Somebody else is saying about the environment, we need to understand better what we're putting into our mouths, which is an ongoing conversation on the show when it comes to food and food supply and the origins of food and how we are, the whole sort of chain events when it comes from the soil and those chain of events that leads to our table and plate.
It's the Sunday Quiz, only on Dubai Today, on Dubai Eye 103.8.
And I've got on the line Anne and Fatima. Good afternoon to you, ladies.
Good afternoon.
Hello there. Anne, Fatima, let's start with you. Anne, are you a science buff? Do you like your science and technology?
Well, my son is a little bit. Which one?
Anne first. Anne first.
Is that me?
Oh, okay.
Who's called Anne?
I'm called Anne.
Okay, so what do you think about science?
Okay, my son is a huge science buff, so I learn from him mostly. He even knows how all the Star Wars alphabet and how to write in it. He's just huge on it. So if I don't win this quiz, I'll be disappointing him hugely.
Fantastic. I love that you're learning from the son, but you know what? It's all down to him today. So if you don't win, you've got to get him to try harder.
Okay.
Thanks.
He's not here.
I know. Good. But you can play back the podcast to him later. Fantastic. Well, thanks for being a good sport. And Fatima, how about you? Do you like your science and technology?
Well, I do, yes, but I do not get so much time to learn about it. But I've been listening from my husband and my daughter, a lot of things they inform me. Sometimes I remember them and sometimes I just hear them and
Oh, good. So you're curious, which is, we like that on Dubai Today. Well, ladies, you are playing the Sunday quiz with the theme of out of this world. Now, we've got Judge Jo here. She is going to be keeping a firm eye on the score and making sure we are all playing correctly. Hello to you, Jo.
Good afternoon.
You've got your pen and paper ready?
Oh, indeed. And my scoreboard.
Excellent stuff. So, ladies, Anne and Fatima, are you ready to play the Sunday quiz?
Yes.
Excellent. Now, you will have just 4 seconds to answer the and I'm going to start with you, Anne. You're the going first. In fact, you've got 5 seconds countdown, so I will need your answer within the 5 seconds. Now, we've got Adam Griffin here. I'm going to get him to play against you as well. Are you up for that, Adam?
Oh, yes. I'm slightly nervous about this, actually. My heart's between the coffee and this quiz. I'm feeling a little anxious.
Well, here we go. It's all good fun. Let's play the Sunday quiz. And I'm going to start with you, Anne, with your first question. Here you go. A character from Star Wars, what is the name of the resourceful droid who shows great bravery and loyalty towards his masters and friends? He's a small droid who is just 1.9 metres tall and rolls around on three legs.
R2-D2? Is that the old one?
Adam, what do you say?
Oh, yes, R2-D2 has to be. Three legs was a giveaway. Could have been BB-8 otherwise.
Well, Anne, you are absolutely right. R2-D2, yay. There you go. Now, Fatima, here is your first question. Published in 1949, what is the name of the modern classic novel written by George Orwell that portrays a nightmarish vision, an imaginary world in the future that is very convincing? What is the name of that novel? Need an answer?
I don't know. I've forgotten it.
Adam?
I know it.
You're going to kick yourself. It's 1984. Required reading for everyone.
So Adam's absolutely right, and I'm afraid, Fatima.
Aww.
Not to worry. There's all to play for. So Anne, here is your second question. Published in 1818, English writer Mary Shelley wrote the Gothic thriller that is the story of a young scientist who creates a grotesque creature in an unusual scientific experiment. What is the name of the novel?
Frankenstein.
And I'm not even going over to Adam, because you are absolutely right. We've been talking about it this morning. Frankenstein.
You could be a clever clogs and say it's Frankenstein, a modern Prometheus is the full title.
Oh,
that would be very clever.
Too clever, Adam. There you go. Fatima, here is your second question. A character from Star Wars, what is the name of the legendary Jedi Master who is small in size, but a wise and powerful Jedi Master who trained Luke Skywalker?
I don't know.
Adam?
It's Yoda.
And Yoda is absolutely right, but I'm afraid, Fatima, that is a...
Aww.
And here's your third and final question. The film E.T. is the story of a gentle alien who becomes stranded on Earth and befriends a young boy named Elliot. Elliot takes E.T. into his suburban California house, where he decides to try and keep E.T.'s existence a secret. Who directed the film E.T.?
Steven Spielberg?
You know what, Anne? You are right. And so's your dog.
Yeah, brilliant.
And Fatima, here is your third and final question. The film The Martian is the story of a group of astronauts who blast off from the planet Mars and leave behind one of their astronaut colleagues, Mark Watney. Stranded on Mars, he uses his knowledge to find a way to survive on the hostile planet. What is the name of the actor who played the lead role of Mark Watney in the film The Martian?
I don't know. I have absolutely no idea about it.
Do you know Adam Griffin?
I do indeed. You should watch it. It was a very good movie. It's Matt Damon.
Matt Damon. That is absolutely right. Scores on the doors, Judge Joe.
We have a clean sweep with Anne. She got all three answers correct. Well done.
Yay!
So, well done to you, Anne, and your dog and your son for all of the help and that. No, that's well done. Well done indeed. And bad luck to Fatima. But thanks for playing, Fatima. And yeah, really, thanks for being a good sport. You have a lovely day, Fatima.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. I've never been, so I'm looking forward to that.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, you'll enjoy it. Thank you so much for playing the Sunday quiz.
Thank you.
Now, talking science today with my panel of guests, and you're hearing there from Adam Griffin. He's a senior paediatric occupational therapist at the Kamali Clinic. He's also a regular at Cafe Scientifique. He's a Dubai member. Our guest today, that is arts and culture editor of New Scientist magazine, that is Simon Ings, alongside regular on the show, that is Dr. Samineh Shaheen, professor of organisational behaviour and leadership at Holt University and learning and people development specialist. And, you know, having some fun there with science, sci-fi, science fiction, movies. But, you know, in the world of science and the money that is put behind research and investment into moving us forward as a human race, as governments, as countries, communities, it's quite phenomenal. But it's not always an easy journey. And we've been looking and exploring from Simon's latest non-fiction book, which is Stalin and the Scientists, where back in history may be deemed or called the mad scientist, where it was very oppressive culture, society at the time, and maybe their ideas or their opinions and their research weren't finding their way through, and maybe comparing that a little bit to today as well. Now, just give us a bit before we get back into proper discussion, Simon, but with the new scientist, how long have you been editor?
I've been working on the arts pages, editing the arts pages for the last 3 years. It's a dream job, quite frankly. I get to edit the books pages, but I also get to swan around galleries and exhibitions and things like that, because the there is no clear division between how we describe science and the art that we make using particular technologies, or the art that we make about a particular technology or scientific idea. The two bleed into each other quite naturally and quite successfully. So I get to play in galleries for a living, which is amazing.
And which I think is amazing. And, you know, you started your career writing science fiction stories, novels and films, then into, you know, I think your first book was The Eye, A Natural History Exploring the Science of Vision, looking at the chemistry, physics and biology of the eye. Is that right?
That's right. I was reviewing science books, because the thing about popular science is that there are some extraordinary writers out there, really beautiful, beautiful works, and they have the shelf life of your average unrefrigerated yogurt, because of course the science continues to move on, and so these books fall out of favour in a way. So I was invited to review books, science books, as if they were literature, which of course many of them are, and then met an agent who had got so fed up reading my review, so he said, it's time you wrote your own science book, mate. So I ended up writing about the eye, and so I've ended up with this strange sort of split career between a novelist and a popular science writer.
Excellent. How many books have you written?
10. Wow. Now, including the novels, yes. So it's I can keep busy. I'm you know, as long as it's a good bus service, then I can type away. Yes,
you'll see Simon away in Dubai on the metro. That's up, right, and down, oh, with his laptop.
Metro's fantastic.
There you go.
I'm a big fan of the metro.
Excellent. Well, listen, when we come back, we're going to get back into discussion, talking about science, the mad scientist. We're also going to look at some news stories that my panel have picked up on, which kind of feeds into what we're talking about today as well. Take a look at some of the news stories catching the eye of my panel today. And with a new administration in the United States when it comes to President Trump, and we were just at Abu Dhabi Sustainability Week, and a lot of what was on the discussion points there was about the environment and about President Trump's announcements and thoughts about the environment and his belief that, you know, climate change isn't really happening. Through the magazine New Scientist, or with the new stories that we're looking at here, how do you see this playing out, and is this something to be concerned about, or is it actually an opportunity potentially for the population?
I think while the idea of one of the most industrially developed nations on Earth taking a four-year break from trying to tackle human-generated climate change is extremely frightening, if I were in any kind of business, I would be rubbing my hands together, because there is an extraordinary opportunity, especially if you come from somewhere relatively well-funded like China, to develop an infrastructure that will actually work when the oil and the coal are too expensive to pull out of the ground. And we're pretty much there already. The developments in solar energy, the developments in wind power have been absolutely extraordinary over the past 5 years. And I think that the Trump administration, for reasons that we can sort of develop and go into, are missing an incredible trick here, in that they say that they want to create a renewed infrastructure for the United States. And they absolutely need one. They absolutely need one. They're absolutely right about that. Unfortunately, it's going to be the wrong infrastructure. It's going to be based on fuels that are going to get more expensive rather than more cheap. It's based on things that are going to damage the environment rather than restore it. There is an extraordinary opportunity now to develop a low or no carbon economy and infrastructure. I only wish I had any kind of business now to be part of it. I think it's going to be extraordinary.
Have you found through the magazine and feedback from your readers and your contributors as well with regards to climate change and the environment, as in, is that high on people's agenda? I mean, I'm not talking about governments, I'm talking about individuals, because we talk about it and some of us might have an interest or concern, but in amongst all the other things that people think about and are concerned about, do you think the environment is high on the list?
I think it is high on the list because climate change is making a visible, recognisable, visceral difference to people's lives. We are seeing the climate change around us. If we're farmers, we're seeing droughts or unexpected floods. If we're buying house insurance, wherever we happen to be buying insurance for our houses, it's, why is my premium double? Well, that's because an entire village was practically swept away last year. And so the awareness is there. What I think we lack is not science or good science communication. I think we have excellent science communication. What I think we lack is a conversation about values. What I find extraordinary is that we don't have a conversation that doesn't ignore the science, but puts the science to one side for a moment and goes, we're stewards of this planet, and many of the world's great religions have spoken about our stewardship of this planet. Let's look around and take stock. And it seems extraordinary to me that humanities and the arts aren't doing more. The scientists are working till they're blue in the face to say, this is what we know, and it's actually good data. But that's very hard to translate into the lives of people who, frankly, have their own jobs to do and have their own lives to lead. You can sit there taking a grand view of everything, but the reason I take a grand view of everything is, guess what? I'm paid to. I'm put in that position. I can do that. For me to say, oh, people should think about this all the time is ludicrous. Mm. People have their own jobs to do. And it needs the whole culture to be engaged with this issue rather than expecting only science to address it.
Mm. Working with young people in the UAE, Adam, is that a conversation that comes up? Do young people show concern for the environment?
Yeah, absolutely. Those are, and it's really a privilege working in Dubai because I'm lucky enough to work with a very informed group of young people. I'm continuously impressed by kind of how motivated they are. But they, to be honest, the generation I work with seems a little bit kind of ticked off with my generation and the generation before me, that why haven't we done anything? We're sort of leaving the mess for them to clean up. And they're totally correct.
Taking better care.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things they do say is they feel that it's off-putting because you get the impression that what can one person do? It seems like such a big issue, especially if you have, and this is the frustrating thing for me about like the administration in the US taking a kind of step backwards, is if you have large administrations like in the US and China who are not engaging with this, then what difference can one individual make, or even a community, when you have this? It seems like a drop in the ocean by comparison. So you do need the whole culture to kind of get on board, and then it just becomes something we do now. It's a change across the board, but if it's just one person, you can make a difference, so be part of that change.
Mm. Psychologically, yeah. How it affects people, and then communities, and then the wider community organizations, governments.
Absolutely, and it reminds me of a Native American expression that says, we didn't inherit the world from our ancestors, we've borrowed it from our children. And no wonder, you know, it upsets this generation, because going back to our point of rational versus irrational thinking, there is this sort of cognitive dissidence as a cognitive bias that exists psychologically, that we convince ourselves that it's okay not to do anything because there are other things that are more important today. You know, what I have for dinner, for example, and we're very short-sighted when it comes to preserving the environment. And so you have to be aware of those cognitive biases and irrational thoughts, and to be more in tuned in terms of cultural values and preservation, or else none of us are going to survive it.
Adam and I were on a show last week with young people of the UAE talking, as we do regularly, about the internet and learning from young people about technology, because they know more than we do. It's rapidly changing all the time. And part of the conversation last week was about online shaming and identity theft and things like that. And, you know, we kind of almost have, I suppose, an air of cynicism about what young people are doing on the internet and their engagement with technology. Is like it's overtake. We were talking about gaming last week and the idea that it maybe overtakes their life. And yet, and you can tell me better, Simon, living in the UK, I was reading that with the series by David Attenborough, Planet, how so many young people of the UK engaged with that TV show. Take away the phones, the smartphone, the tablets and video games. They were watching about our natural earth, about our planet, and really cared about it.
What we get a lot of in the office are people of a certain generation, namely my generation, saying that the world is going to hell in a handcart because young people are using technology in ways that we don't quite understand. At the same time, we also get a lot of really canny papers which try and put figures on this. And what transpires is that everybody assumes that the young are using new technology. It's almost always the 30-somethings and the 40-somethings that are using the latest platform. The young grew up with this stuff. They know what it's for. It's not new. It's not novel. It's not a trend. It's just part of the natural wealth of the world that they will use in a particular way. And they are so much more canny than the adults or the older people who are inveighing against this. There's a very good account of by a researcher called Dana Boyd, called It's Complicated, and it looks at young people's use of social media in particular. And the conclusion is really quite brusque. It says, well, if you want people not to use social media, maybe let them out the house. Maybe let them meet each other. And yes, these platforms do allow certain kinds of behaviours to proliferate. So there is a problem around bullying, hugely exaggerated and put on the onus of the people rather than the technology itself. It's solvable. Once we spot the problem, we can fix it. We can probably fix the really big problem at the moment, which is confirmation bias. The fact that if you get your news from social media, the way it's set up is to give you information that is close to you. And that's why it's great. That's why you get to know about Uncle Tony's new car or horse or whatever it happens to be. But if you do that with news, all you ever get is what you already know, and it goes to hell in a handcart very, very quickly. But this is fixable. It's not social chaos is not going to erupt. It's just that somebody who has their hand on the technology has to do a better job.
Continuing the discussion, stay with us. There's one of the stories, news stories that caught my eye. I won't go into all of it, but just about NASA's Juno spacecraft that skimmed past Jupiter's north and south pole and returning data on the giant planet and its atmosphere. This was off the back of a previous mission where there was a problem with technology and science and they lost the data. And it makes you think about how much money is invested into science research, or in this particular instance, space travel. And, you know, it does beg the question, is, especially when things go wrong, does it deserve so much investment? Adam?
Yeah, that's a tough one. It always comes back to, people will talk about that, because anything to do with space, getting anything out of orbit, is phenomenally expensive. The term should be used astronomically, literally expensive, because the Space Edge project, to Elon Musk's big space project, that got a lot of press because he seemed to keep crashing rockets right, left and center. But the thing about crashing those rockets is every time they got better at not crashing the next one. But it is a little bit kind of, people find it scandalous when they talk about the average rocket launch costs $57 million. And then, oh my goodness, what could that money be spent on otherwise? But when you get into this cost of rockets versus hospitals, that's not really the debate to have. But it is very natural for people to sort of see it that way. But science, it will always have these failures built into it. It is important to fail in science. Some of the most important things you can do. When I'm speaking to children and the kids I work with all the time, the quotes, I love quotes, as people have heard me, anyone who knows me knows, but one of my favorites is, of course, from a fellow Irishman, with Samuel Beckett, said, "Ever tried, ever failed. No matter, try again. Fail, fail better." So, and science has that.
Simon, you know, and particularly with what we're talking about at the beginning of the show about wanting everything to be neat and connected and, yes, and get resolution.
Well, having just written this book on the Soviet Union's approach to science, what struck me was that the government embraced an idea of science that was always going to more or less stay the same, and just we dot the I's, cross the T's, and your basic science will stay the same. Well, it didn't work out that way, and one of the most celebrated scientists and bureaucrats and organizers of that time was a man called Nikolai Pavlov, who created the first food banks. He would go to places in the Hindu Kush and find out where our food comes from. And he would gather seeds and plants and put them into institutions. Well, there's one in Ethiopia which he founded, which is still going. He very proudly recognises that Pavlov established that centre. There's now seed banks in Svalbard is the famous one, which holds our food supply. Now, that food supply is entirely reliant, and our food supply today is entirely reliant on space exploration. Because one of the things that Pavlov was able to do was to say, well, these particular seeds work really well in drought areas, and these particular seeds work particularly well in areas where there's too much rainfall. And so the number of seeds that were actually grown across the world lessened, and fewer types of seeds now being grown than used to be the case. The consequence of that is there's more food, and so it can support a bigger population. And now we need weather forecasts, not the ones you get on the radio, but micro forecasts that tell you what the weather is going to be in the next 6 hours, or are going to be in the next 3 hours, or half an hour, or the next day. And those forecasts come to you through your mobile phone from satellites. And so were satellites all to drop out of the sky tomorrow, we would start to go hungry. And I don't just mean the poor would go hungry. I mean us, the people sitting in front of the fancy microphones in the studio. All of us would start to go hungry. Now, nobody knew what technology was necessary to create a fantastically well-fed global population, the biggest and best-fed global population there has ever been. We had no idea what technology would be necessary to create that situation. What we had to do was fail. What we had to do was throw things at the world and see what works, because if you're not failing, you're not learning. And if the Soviet experience teaches you anything, Nikolai Pavlov was killed by the state, because he came up with too many big ideas at a time when people wanted easy answers. If you just do what you know, the world is changing around you. The situation, you know, the circumstances will change around you and will give you such a kick in the, kick in the backside. If you don't keep learning, if you don't keep investing, if you don't spend the money to get things wrong in order to find out something right at the end of it.
So from an organizational perspective, I couldn't agree more. And we're trying to, you know, sort of roll these out in companies as well. And one of the projects that I worked on was really, really just incredible in terms of how the leadership approached this issue, with the concept of fail fast, you know, that we want to encourage teams to fail, but fail fast. So there should be this resilience of bouncing back and learning from that failure, right? So at the beginning of the performance review cycle, they would have four cards, and they called them failure or mistake cards. And by the next review cycle, the employees or the team members should have used at least three of those, or else they'll be downgraded or they'll be marked, you know, lower in their performance review. Why? Because if you haven't used your mistake card, it means you haven't taken risks and you haven't learned from what could be done otherwise. But you need the culture and the leadership to support this so that people aren't terrified of making mistakes.
And failure.
Yeah, there's a really fantastic book that goes into this as well called Black Box Thinking. And they talk about this whole is by a guy called Matthew Zayed, who's a wonderful writer, but he talks about how the aviation industry learned from that, that when he had mistakes, each mistake the aviation industry made had real life or death consequences, so they had to learn really, really fast. So if someone identified a mistake, they weren't persecuted from it, they were rewarded for coming forward. And I actually judged my own industry in healthcare, in medicine in particular, that we were so afraid of making mistakes and taking ownership on it. That means progress sort of stagnates a little bit. And something you see, I work with it a lot, and you see it in Dubai, where people are terrified of what their manager might say, so they don't want to speak up. So you need to change that culture within the organization, as you were just talking about.
Break love to the science in an act of good defiance. I broke her heart. As I pulled apart her theories, as I watched her growing weary, I pulled her apart. Half and heavy conversations about the furthest constellations of our soul.
fascinating discussion today. It's the third time I've used that word, because it totally is. We're talking about science today and, you know, exploring the idea of how much should be invested in science research, and through history where people that were either free thinkers or were making great moves in developing humans and the world, but were held back because of bias, and how that leaves people, countries, states, how it influences us. Now, lots of people texting in on this. Let me just bring this down to the everyday sort of connection, if you will. Robbie says, I used to love watching Arthur C. Clarke when I was growing up. So we can talk a little bit about Arthur C. Clarke. The thumbs just went up from people in the studio on that. But goes on to say, it's a shame that when we say science, it makes us think of boring lessons at school, chemistry, physics, and the like. I think that is sad, and one would hope that for we've moved on from that idea. But let me get the thoughts from my panel. So, Simon, Arthur C. Clarke, great influencers of our sort of modern times.
Loved him.
Yeah.
Loved him. Read everything. Loved him. Then discovered John Wyndham, and then J.G. Ballard. So I go the full gamut, really. And I think what all those very, very different writers have in common is a sense of curiosity. And it's curiosity you want to foster, ideally, to get a healthy healthy society in terms of how it responds to science. The data can wait maybe years. I'm only discovering new kinds of music at the moment. But that's because I'm curious about music and I've stumbled into a new kind of music that I'm interested about. It's not a tragedy that I knew nothing about this kind of music 30, 40 years ago. And I think we should have the same attitude towards science as towards the rest of the culture. That what we want to foster is as an enthusiasm for and a curiosity about science. I think certain sciences are always going to be difficult to teach. Mathematics is notoriously difficult to teach. It's been so difficult to teach for so long. I think we just have to hold our hands up and say, this is hard. This is hard, and it is difficult, and it's not, the problem is not going to go away. And I think, to a certain extent, there's going to be that problem with science always, because it's uncomfortable.
Yeah, what's troubling for me sometimes is when I work, and I always bring them up on the show, but I have two beautiful daughters, and kids come hardwired, prepared for science. They're little baby scientists straight out. As soon as they pop, kind of spiking you into the world, they're little baby Einsteins, every one. But that's kind of drummed out of them a little bit. So when I work with some of the kind of young kids and teenagers, they kind of shrug, and you see all the air go out of them when I mention science and how enthused I am. They find, frankly, obnoxious that I'm so excited about science, and this is terrible. But if I can, almost invariable, I'll be able to find an enthusiasm they have, whether it's Minecraft or space travel or anything like that, and we'll bring them back around. It's you're just curious about something. Science is just another aspect of that. Anything in the world is interesting if you look at it from a certain angle. So that's, anyone who's looked around and said, well, that's funny, that's a scientific impulse you've got right there.
Yeah, and encouraging that for young people, but also for adults. And as you age, it doesn't mean that you have to close those blinkers little by little over the eyes. You can still open those blinkers and be curious and venture through your life and world and the way you view the world. It doesn't have to get smaller just because you're getting older. So that, I love that word, curious, and it's important for us all to have that. For you, Simon, I know you're working on your next book, The Smoke. In fact, is it complete?
It is. I delivered it the other day.
So congratulations. So what's that about?
It's a science fiction novel. I went back to science fiction with this one, and it's about a future London. I didn't realise it when I started working on it, but it's my Brexit novel. It's about two communities who honestly don't understand each other, going through a very, very painful and disastrous divorce. So, yes, I come from a broken country. And I have written a novel about a broken country. So that's what that's about.
And I know this deserves much longer time, but just a quick preview, if you will, about Darcy Wentworth Thompson, the centenary.
Oh, bless. Yeah, no, I wanted to mention this chap. It's a century since a book called On Growth and Form. And this was written by a biologist who had virtually no mathematics. He didn't have a lot of maths to hand, but he wanted to know why all kinds of different kinds of crab, say crab, or dog or cat or something, why they all look vaguely similar but they all take on radically different forms. And he wasn't interested in evolution. He wasn't interested in genetics. What he was interested in was the fact that if you draw a sort of dog shape on a piece of graph paper and then you stretch that graph paper in different directions, what you see emerging from that graph paper are all the different kinds of dogs in the world. And what he found was a sort of mathematical lawfulness to development. And everyone recognized that this was pure genius, that it was brilliant. And everyone knew it, and everyone celebrated him, and everyone wrote about him, and no one had the foggiest idea what to do with him, because they just discovered the gene, and it's like, he's discovered something so peculiar, and we have no handle on it. And it's only now that we're beginning to understand how that maths plays out in the real world. And it's this wonderful story of, normally the story is, you come up with this wonderful radical idea and you're a mad scientist, and everyone ignores you and says, no, this is crazy. When with Thompson was quite the opposite, everyone went, this is really cool, and we completely have no idea what to do with it, and we're just going to wait around until we have the mathematics necessary to figure out what's going on. And that's what it took. It took computers to understand what he was getting at.
A big thank you to my guest today. That is Adam Griffin, Senior Paediatric Occupational Therapist at the Kamali Clinic. Thank you. A big thank you to Dr. Samina Shaheen, Professor of Organisational Behaviour and Leadership at Holt University and Learning and People Development Specialist. Thank you. And a big thank you to Simon Ings, Art and Culture Editor for the New Scientist magazine. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening and for all your messages today.